Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and on today's show, you'll hear three interviews that we recorded earlier this week at the J Street Conference in Washington, D.C. J Street was formed by progressive Jews in America who are challenging the hegemony of AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, which has a stranglehold on American policy on Israel, the Palestinians, and the Middle East. The activists of J Street represent the idea that our foreign policy should not just be about love for Israel, but for peace and freedom for Palestinians as well. Over 2,700 people attended the conference in Washington over the weekend, and we caught up with three of the people who spoke and presented their ideas. First, you'll hear my conversation with Gidon Bromberg, Israeli director of Friends of the Earth Middle East, who joins us to talk about the Sacred River Jordan and cleaning it up, and how to equitably solve the biggest battle of the 21st century, the right to water. Then we'll speak with Ronit Avni, a filmmaker and political activist who made the documentary Boudros to highlight the many untold stories of nonviolent cooperation between Palestinians and Israelis in their joint struggle for justice in the Holy Land. Finally, we'll hear from Professor Bernard Avishai, one of the most important thinkers of the 21st century reality of Israel and Palestine. But first, let's get you home safe with WEAA traffic, and then we'll be right back with our interview with Gidon Bromberg. This is Mark Steiner. We are at the J Street Conference in Washington, D.C. at the Convention Center. A series of interviews today here in Washington with activists from Israel and the Middle East. We are about to have a conversation with Gidon Bromberg, who is the Israeli head of Friends of the Earth Middle East. And Gidon, good to meet you. Good to have you in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's absolutely delightful to be here.
That's good to have you. So tell us a bit, just for our listeners who may have heard of Friends of the Earth, but Friends of the Earth Middle East is something that most people, I think, have not heard of.
So we're a truly unique organization. We're the only organization in the Middle East that brings Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians together. I'm the Israeli director, but I have a Palestinian co-director, a Jordanian co-director. We work out of Tel Aviv, Bethlehem, and Amman with a common purpose, with a common vision, and that is to both promote sustainable development, mostly on our shared water resources, and to promote lasting peace amongst our peoples.
Now, let's start with something we talked about before we jumped here on these mics, which was your work around the Jordan River. And one of the things that also brings you to here, besides J Street, is your work around the Jordan River and reclaiming that. So talk about, A, the river first, as this kind of river that's a holy body of water to all three of the Abrahamic religions.
I don't think there's a child on earth that hasn't a vision, an image of the River Jordan. It's part of our mother's milk for all of us, Jews, Christians, and Muslims.
Right.
It's a holy site. Yet the world doesn't know that the conflict has led to the utter demise of this river. 98% of the fresh waters of the Jordan River have been taken away. They've been taken away because conflict leads to competition. Nobody wants to share the water. Israel, Syria, Jordan have blocked off the sources of the River Jordan in their territory so that they don't have to share that water, which is scarce, with their neighbors. As soon as the fresh water was taken away, then quite quickly sewage became the main flow. And so the River Jordan, a river holy to so many of us around the globe, has been turned into little more than a sewage canal.
So we have this river that among Christians they believe that Jesus was baptized in this river. Many of Muhammad's major figures around him are buried near the Jordan River.
Yes.
It's in the Old Testament. It's in every black spiritual that you can think of crossing the Jordan. So talk a bit about what has happened to it, though, literally. I mean, what has happened to destroy it? Where is the water gone? I mean, how has it been destroyed over these years?
So the river has met an absolute demise for competing purposes. We've used that water for our domestic drinking purposes. We've used that water for agriculture, a lot of agriculture. We've developed an economy, a water economy, that doesn't reflect the water scarcity that we have in the region, so that Israel is a major exporter of agricultural produce to Europe. Jordan is an exporter of agricultural produce to the Gulf states. We're utilizing those scarce water resources in a manner of exporting those waters to water affluent parts of the world in Europe or even here in North America. You go into Whole Foods and you can find fruits and vegetables from the Middle East. We're actually exporting those waters.
So what would save the river? I mean, what would bring it back?
A concerted effort, a concerted cooperative effort of both bringing some of the water back. We're not calling for all of those waters. In fact, we're calling for somewhere around a third. And we've conducted a study together with friends here in the United States at Yale University as to what is the amount of water needed to rehabilitate that river, to have a healthy river again. Not the historical flow, but to have a river of environmental integrity. So we need to agree, and Israel, Jordan, in the future, Syria, will need to agree to return some of that water. And we've actually calculated how much each side...
The headwaters are in Syria.
A third of the headwaters are in Syria. About a quarter are in Jordan, and the rest are in Israel. Israel has captured close to a half of the historical flow of the Jordan, and therefore we're calling on Israel to return as a percentage something more than a half.
And that water is going to irrigate farms?
It's going to,
or more?
It's going to irrigate farms. It's going to domestic purposes. Legitimate. We're not saying that agriculture and domestic water needs are illegitimate in our region. It's the lifestyle, it's the consumption patterns that we lead. We pretend, we'd like to think that we're in Northern Europe or North America. We continue to have gardens with lawns. We grow tropical fruits like bananas, even though we're in the desert. And therefore, we all do it.
It's an interesting shift in consciousness, what you're talking about. Let's just say this one example. If you grew up Jewish, or if you grew up loving Israel in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, one of the things that was pushed all the time was the garden out of the desert,
yes.
Was making the desert bloom.
Yes.
But making the desert bloom has its costs.
It's completely unsustainable. And maybe we didn't understand that in the 30s and 40s.
We probably did not.
No. But today we do understand that making the desert bloom for the export of food, for our own food security, for our own food production purposes, that continues to make sense. But to export agricultural produce, not only utilizing our water, but subsidizing farmers throughout the region, receive water at heavily subsidized prices. Farmers in Jordan receive water almost for free. So there's an incredible amount of waste. And what we're about is striking the balance.
I'm curious how you think you strike that balance. I mean, if agricultural systems are made for export, not, say, feeding the people of Israel, Jordan, maybe more so on the West Bank, but maybe not. But if that's for export, then how does that change? I mean, if your economy is, part of your economy is based on selling Jaffa oranges to the rest of the world, how does that become a sustainable economy?
So the fact is that it's no longer a significant a part of our economies. It's 1-2% of GDP in Israel is based on agriculture, even though over 50% of our water resources go to that sector. It's 3-4% of the economy in Jordan, even though some 65% of water resources in Jordan go to that particular sector. So it's part of a vision that's not the reality today. It's part of the mystique of making the desert bloom that the public have rejected. Jews were denied in Eastern Europe the opportunity to work the land, and therefore was very attractive as part of the Zionist endeavor to get your hands dirty and come and work the land. But less than 1% of the Israeli populace is employed in agriculture. We'd rather be a high-tech economy than an agriculturalist economy. And most of the hard labor in agriculture in Israel is done by Chinese and Thai laborers. It's not necessary for the Israeli economy to continue to export water in the sphere of fruits and vegetables and flowers, and we need to stop it because we're paying, nature is paying a horrible price, and we're losing other options. We're losing a tourism industry along the River Jordan. We're making it more difficult to share water with our Palestinian neighbor, and that's a key issue because of the shared waters between Israelis and Palestinians. Israel takes the lion's share. Israel takes some 80% of that shared water. If we were not to utilize water so unsustainably, we could release more water more fairly to our Palestinian neighbors and to nature. And that's the very basis of our call at Friends of the Earth Middle East.
I mean, it's not just, I mean, it's also an American dilemma. If you go to Las Vegas, if you go to Southern California, if you go to Arizona, you know, lush green lawns amidst the desert.
Absolutely. America is a terrible model. And in fact, we brought the mayors of Jordanian, Palestinian, and Israeli cities along the Jordan River to the Colorado and to see the utter demise of that river. There are stretches of the Colorado which are completely dry. And we had the mayors walk along the dry riverbed to highlight to them that this is the future of the Jordan if you don't, you know, be
active.
What
was their response?
It was fabulous. And since then, every year, we've been holding an event called the Big Jump, where we bring the mayors, Palestinian, Jordanian, and Israeli, to jump into a clean section of the River Jordan together. And they do it in front of television with their, you know, big bellies out there. But they do it because they've come to understand. And we've been working on this issue for, you know, 6-7 years. They've come to understand that they will benefit much more from a healthy river than the current use of the water resources.
I mean, and even beyond the Jordan River, we wind our way back to that place before we finish, but many people have posited that the 21st century struggle will be water throughout the world, whether we're looking at the real reason why the Chinese want to keep Tibet or going back home to the Middle East and Turkey, and the headwaters in Syria, and where those waters flow and how they flow and how they get to Iraq and how they get to Jordan and how they get to Israel and to Palestine. I mean, that this will be the issue that could be the crux of many things in this next 20 years.
It really depends on our ingenuity in how we adapt our lifestyles. Some will say that it's a technological fix and we can just desalinate ourselves out of the problem. There are former Israeli water ministers that have come and said that Israel doesn't have a water problem. There's as much water for Israel as there is water in the Mediterranean Sea. All we need to do is desalinate. Now, we don't agree with that position.
Why?
Because of the energy needs of desalination. Until we develop and invest in renewable energies to a significant level, then current energy and high energy use out of desalination is polluting our environment. It's contributing heavily to excessive CO2 emissions, and therefore it's currently not sustainable. It's great technology that has a place, but it must be introduced as the last option and not the first option. The first option is to conserve our water, is to use our water much more wisely in the agricultural sector. That's one place, but also in the domestic sector. We flush our toilets. I'm sorry to speak on this particular issue, but
it's
crucial because we flush our toilets with drinking water. We do it here in the United States.
Right.
We do it in Europe. We do it also in the Middle East. Now, that is madness. A third of the water we consume is flushed down the toilet. A third of the water that we consume at home, we shower with. We could simply capture that grey water. The shower water is perfectly fine water to be flushing the toilet with. We can capture that water and use it in the very same day. It requires a simple investment. It doesn't require massive technologies. And that's part of the problem because ministers like to have ribbon-cutting ceremonies of major desalination plants. It's not very attractive to have a ribbon-cutting ceremony in front of a new toilet.
a compost toilet as opposed to a flush toilet.
And the compost toilet would even go further. So although water scarcity, and particularly with climate change, is of great concern, there's a great deal that we can do to prevent water scarcity becoming a crisis. Water scarcity in the Middle East is a fact. It's always been a fact. It's how we adapt our lifestyles to the climatic conditions that are naturally found in our part of the world.
So, before you kind of wander into mountain aquifers and other things here, I want to know what you think it would take, since the conversations happen in America as well, in terms of changes in how the Israeli society lives, how people in Israel live, to do the things you're talking about with water. I mean, it clearly, it's going to take some kind of change in the way we do what we do every day.
First and foremost, it's pricing. You know, we're an economy that people react to the price signals. And those changes are now coming into place, partly due to desalination, because desalination is still expensive. The price of water in Israel has tripled in the last 2 years.
And the cost of turning on your tap.
The cost of turning on your tap, yes. So people are looking for ways to conserve water like they never were looking before. So the price signal is an important aspect of change, and that encourages further technological solutions, such as grey water and rainwater harvesting. You know, we have rainfall on our roofs, but we don't capture that rain. We allow that rain to go into the gutter and sadly hit the road and then go onto the beach. And we could be capturing rainwater and storing it and having it for several months into the spring, instead of using the groundwater and the Mediterranean and the Sea of Galilee water. That type of investment becomes economically reasonable when the price of water better reflects scarcity. That's also the case here in the United States, where water is cheap. You look at the European example, and water is very expensive, and therefore you see tremendous ingenuity. So pricing water to reflect its true value, including its environmental value, the fact that we've taken that water away from its natural setting, that the price there must be reflected.
Huge.
Yes, absolutely. Because we've also lost opportunities. The Jordan River, as an example, last year at a baptism site just south of the Sea of Galilee, had 700,000 visitors, pilgrims, coming to be baptized in those waters. That's the second or third largest figure of tourist visitation in any one particular site in Israel. That speaks to the tourist potential. Now, people can only go there because just a kilometer south of that point, right near the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan no longer exists. It's a sewage canal. So striking that balance.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. It is a river the width that you can jump across.
It's been laid in concrete as a sewer. Is that what you're saying?
No, the fresh water has been taken away.
Oh, I see. So it's remote, has remained.
Sewage is the only thing that's remained. Sewage and agricultural runoff and saline waters that have been dumped there. It stinks. It smells. It's a tragedy. There, too, changes are taking place because of public outcry. One of the things that we've very successfully done is brought tens of thousands of people to the border to see the state of the River Jordan from the Israeli side, from the Jordanian side, from the Palestinian side. Because the river is the border, there's a fence. So access has been extremely limited. When the public can't see, it doesn't know. So we've made arrangements. We've taken people to spots where there's a possibility to see the state of the river, and there's been an outcry. So in Israel, two municipalities are investing over 300 million shekels today because of the public outcry in building a sewage treatment facility. By the end of this year, in fact, there'll be no more sewage from the Israeli side into the River Jordan. The sewage is being removed, but the river might be completely dry at the end of this year. And this is an issue that we think that the American public should know and will react to call on our three governments. And here it's essential. It's the three governments that need to be working together. It can't be just Israel. It can't be Israel and Jordan. It must be Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority. The three of us need to be working together.
Well, what about the elephant in the room, which is the aquifer, which is the mountain aquifer, which is the water that goes to Israel and West Bank, that where Israel takes the lion's share of the water, and the Palestinians are literally kind of starving for water, can't build new wells, can't. So what about that? That is the elephant in the room when it comes to water, it seems to me.
It is, together with the Jordan, because Palestinians have no access to any fresh water from the Jordan River as well. So part of rehabilitation of the River Jordan also means a fair share of those waters to the Palestinians. The mountain aquifer is a ticking time bomb. It's being overpumped. Israel takes the lion's share of 80% of those waters. Palestinians have no guarantee of having fresh water when they turn on their tap. So it's an issue that goes into every single Palestinian home every day, particularly in the summer, where people might have water supplied once every 3 weeks in the heat of the Middle East summer. They have to rely on storing water on their roofs that can be refilled once every 3 weeks, but that means that you can't shower every day. In some cases, you don't send girls to school because there's no longer water in the toilets, and therefore, while boys can go outside, girls simply are not sent to school. So real social issues. We see it as a tremendous opportunity. There's no stronger message of bringing trust, of bringing advances into people's homes than supplying fresh water. At the moment, water is being held hostage to the lack of progress in the peace process. If we were to more fairly share that water, if we were to create an institutional structure of joint management, something on the lines of the International Boundary Waters Commission between Mexico and the United States. A very similar rich country, poor country, dry, arid zones. There's good models around the world that work. India and Pakistan, throughout all of their fighting, have maintained a relationship of cooperation over the Indus. Now, we need to build on that. And again, here in Washington, I'll be meeting with Congress people to speak of that, to speak of the need that water no longer be held hostage to the lack of progress in the peace process. If we allow the more fair share of water resources today, we can move forward in a true confidence-building measure that enters every Palestinian home and enters every Israeli home, enters Palestinian homes through more fresh water and enters Israeli homes by seeing less sewage.
So this is fascinating. I think it's a piece of the struggle that we don't hear about in terms of people who are trying to bridge these gaps. And your physicality is optimistic. Are you optimistic about where this goes?
I'm a diehard optimist, I guess. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing for the last 16 years. But I think that there are some real lessons from the past 16 years that we still haven't learned. The Mubarak regime fell, and Israelis are fearful that the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt will also fall. And it might. It might do that because there is no public support. There is no people-to-people civil society activities between Egyptians and Israelis, even though there's been a peace treaty for 30 years. Peace is more than just a piece of paper, both once you've signed it and even before you get there. We need to build peace, and the message and the lesson that the fall of the Mubarak regime should present the peacemakers is that We need to be investing in people to people, in Israelis and Palestinians meeting and building that trust from the grassroots. That's what gives me optimism, because in our work, we bring Israeli school children, we bring Israeli and Palestinian residents, we bring Israeli and Palestinian mayors together on a daily, on a weekly basis. When you see how the humanity of each other, when you see the common interest that the two sides understand, then I'm given great strength that we can turn this around. If we build on the political will that we so desperately need.
This has been a pleasure. Gidon Bromberg is really director of the Friends of Earth Middle East, and I think it is going to be a bubbling up from the bottom. That's the only way things will really change ultimately, and that's where your work is.
Thank you very, very much.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, and today we're hearing interviews we conducted at the J Street Conference in Washington, D.C. earlier this week. And don't go away, because right after this break, we're back with Ronit Avni, filmmaker and activist. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.